One of the problems I faced was that working with the people around in those areas of racism and sexism often did not have much money to offer me for providing the help that I was giving them. When I was in private practice, I was getting a lot of affluent people coming to me for my services. But just to go out and offer it to people around that would invite me into their communities having heard about it, the initial groups were not very affluent people. And so to get around the United States, it was pretty costly for me to stop overnight and be in a hotel. So much of the time I had to sleep outdoors as I was traveling from city to city. And this was no problem when the weather was good because I had a pretty good sleeping bag, but of course it could be quite uncomfortable in the winter time or when it rained. One day as I was driving through Kansas and I was about to stop because it was nighttime and I needed some sleep on my way back home, the problem was it was raining very hard, and when it did that, I would need to go into the nearby town and find some overhang on some building that I could sleep under. So I went into a place in the nearest town that I could find a little overhang from the roof that I could be protected from the rain, and I got my sleeping bag out of the car and started to sleep. But now the police came by and wondered, who is this strange person who just chooses to get out and sleep underneath that overhang? And they seemed a little worried about me. They had me up against my car with my hands on top, and they were searching me and asking me why I was there. I told that story to some friends of mine, and then a couple months later, they were in a workshop with me and teasing me about that. They said, well, Marshall, have you frightened the police with your sleeping habits, sleeping out under rooftops? And a woman who attended this training, when she heard this, she asked me, Marshall, why do you sleep outdoors like that? And I said, well, you know, many of the people that invite me into their communities don't have much money, and sleeping in a motel is pretty costly for me. And I don't mind sleeping outdoors, it's just that sometimes that rain is awkward, so that's when I go into town and sleep under the overhangs. Anyway, the last day of the workshop, this woman came up to me and said to me, I have something I want to offer you. And she gave me a check for a good sum of money. I was shocked. And I said, what's this about? And she said, it has some strings attached. Oh, I said, what are they? She said, you're not to sleep outdoors anymore. You're to use this money to sleep in hotels and be more comfortable. And I thanked her for her kindness, but I gave her back the check. And she said, why are you giving this back to me? I said, oh, if I was to have that much money, I certainly wouldn't want to use it to make hotel owners more wealthy. She said, well, what would you do with it? I said, I'd use it first to buy a car I could sleep in, and second, I would use it to buy a computer because I'm finding that these computers can help me make mailing lists and get a lot of the work I need to do to spread the word around. It could make it a lot easier. She gave me back the check, and she said, please then buy a car and buy a computer. And she said, but you know what would help? If you had a not-for-profit organization, I could deduct that, and so it would be very helpful to me if you could do that. I said, well, you know, some other people have been telling me there'd be some advantages to my forming a not-for-profit organization. And so I did. I went and formed a not-for-profit organization called the Center for Nonviolent Communication. And then I thought, how do you start an organization where it was getting overwhelming for me to be doing all this by myself? So I sent out a letter to people around the United States and Canada who had been finding my training helpful. And I invited them to come together if they would be interested in sharing with me the challenge of how do we distribute nonviolent communication in a way that it could be helpful to people most in the United States and Canada. I was delighted to find that 23 people came together. They had this interest in working with me on how we could, as a team, make the training more available. But then they were so effective in inviting me all over the United States and Canada, and I was seeing day after day how valuable the process could be, how many people were using it in how many ways. And then I saw that it was far too valuable to make it dependent on my availability. And just at this time, I was reading of the work of Paulo Freire in Brazil. He was then the head of the Department of Education, and Brazil had a very low rate of literacy. And he came up with a very creative program for increasing literacy in Brazil. Instead of having to depend on well-educated teachers to teach reading, he developed a very clever program, and very simple, in which people who were learning how to read could turn around and teach other people how to do it. And through this process, he rapidly spread literacy skills throughout Brazil. But he did something else that was also very clever. He integrated into this literacy teaching to get people to think more about how their government was working and what power they had to change things that were not in harmony with their values. Within a short time, he was getting about 85% of the people literate, whereas when he started out, it was about 3%. Well, this really stimulated me, and I thought, could I make this process so clear that I could teach other people how to teach other people the process? And I started this experiment in three cities that I was working in a lot at the time: San Francisco, California, Toronto, Canada, and Norfolk, Virginia. I found a team of citizens in each area that were finding the process very helpful, and I shared with them how I offered it and showed them how they might teach it to others. Before I knew it, these teams spread to other teams in the United States. And then a woman in one of the cities in California, who was originally from Switzerland, she thought that this process might be very helpful to the people in Switzerland. And she said, if I go over there and describe it to the people in my town that I lived in Switzerland, and some of the people are interested, would you be willing to go there and offer the process? And she went, found people who were interested, and I then went to Switzerland and offered the process. And when people in the United States heard that I was doing that, some people said, well, we know people in Germany. How about while you're over in Switzerland, offering it to people in Germany? And I did, and that started me then in Europe. Now, that was about 30 years ago. Now, in the 30 years since, our process has been spreading throughout the world, so that now we have projects going in about 50 countries, and we have a team of about 200 people who I've trained to offer our training to other people, and in their countries, they're training other people to train other people. So we're seeing a very rapid distribution of this process of nonviolent communication.